there's a Gaza ceasefire deal on the table.
The onus is indeed on Hamas. There is a deal on the table, and they need to take it.
Pro-Palestinian protests continue on U.S. university campuses.
Free! Free Palestine!
Free! Free Palestine!
Taylor Swift's new record shatters records.
And for a fortnight there we were.
Today is Tuesday, April 30th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Scott Walterman. Hamas should accept Israel's proposal for a truce in Gaza, and U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken adds they should do it quickly.
Hamas has before it a proposal that is extraordinarily, extraordinarily generous on the part of Israel. And in this moment, the only thing standing between the people of Gaza and a ceasefire is Hamas. They have to decide. And they have to decide quickly.
It was a message echoed by White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre.
There has been new progress in talks, and currently the onus is indeed on Hamas. There is a deal on the table, and they need to take it. We believe that all efforts need to be brought to bear to convince Hamas to accept the proposal immediately.
What we know of the deal is that it includes a 40-day ceasefire and the release of 1,000 Palestinians for 40 Israeli hostages. That came from British Foreign Minister David Cameron. President Joe Biden spoke on Monday with the leaders of Qatar and Egypt as he is pushing for the deal. Also from the White House on Monday, a comment on the New York Times story that said the International Criminal Court is ready to issue arrest warrants for Israeli and Hamas officials for the October attack and the Gaza invasion.
So we've been really clear about the ICC investigation. We do not support it. We don't believe that they have the jurisdiction. And I'm just going to leave it there for now.
Along those lines, five units of the Israeli military have been found responsible for gross violations of human rights in incidents that took place outside of Gaza before the conflict broke out between Israel and Hamas in October. That news coming from the U.S. State Department on Monday.
All of these were incidents much before October 7th, and none took place in Gaza. Four of these units have effectively remediated these violations, which is what we expect partners to do. It is consistent with what we expect all countries whom with we have a security relationship.
State Department Deputy Spokesperson Venda Patel.
Free! Free Palestine!
Pro-Palestinian protests continued on several dozen U.S. university campuses on Monday. That was from a rally at San Francisco State University.
I'm here protesting because enough is enough. We've been out on the streets for more than 7 months now, calling for the same thing, calling for a ceasefire, calling for freedom for Palestinians. Return the rightful return to land, holding those accountable for the atrocities that's been happening so far, which has not been the case.
The situation was more tense in Austin at the University of Texas, where state troopers on the scene were ordered to arrest student protesters by the state's governor. The University of Southern California in Los Angeles canceled its main commencement ceremony because of safety concerns over the protests. At Columbia University in New York,
a protest encampment at Columbia University remained standing on Monday, well past the 2 p.m. deadline to disperse or face suspension, after the school's president said talks with pro-Palestinian activists had reached an impasse. One key demand of the protesters is that Columbia divest assets that support Israel's military. University President Manoush Shafiq said Columbia would not do so, but offered to invest in health and education in Gaza and make the school's direct investment holdings more transparent. Here's student organizer Sueda Polat.
While the administration offered us a timeline for review of divestment proposals, they refused to give us any commitment that the ultimate decision would be binding. They offered us limited financial disclosure by giving only their direct holdings, yet not the indirect holdings, which account for the vast majority of this university's endowment.
Protesters vowed to keep their encampment on the New York City campus until Columbia meets three demands: divestment, transparency in Columbia's finances, and amnesty for students and faculty disciplined for their part in the protests. Columbia said students who did not vacate the encampment would face suspension and become ineligible to complete the semester in good standing.
Students are currently holding their ground and refusing to be scared by the administration's fear tactics. And we're here in solidarity with Gaza, who continues to hold their ground on their indigenous lands, so we won't be leaving.
Mahmoud Halil is the lead negotiator for Columbia University Apartheid Divest.
This encampment is a minor inconvenience compared to the generational shaping events taking place now in Gaza. This is not a matter of simply violating university rules. This is a movement, an anti-war movement.
2 weeks ago, Shafiq faced an outcry from many students, faculty, and outside observers for summoning New York City police to dismantle the encampment, resulting in more than 100 arrests. Efforts to remove the encampment, which students set up again within days of the April 18th police action, have triggered dozens of similar protests at schools from California to Boston, as well as countries across the globe.
Reuters correspondent Freddie Joyner. So, let's go a little deeper. Students protesting on college campuses is nothing new. Joining us to talk about this is Scott Gack, author, historian, and teacher at Trinity College in Connecticut, where he's a professor of history and American studies. So without getting into the issues of what they're protesting, because I don't want to either glorify or vilify them for what they believe at this age, I did want to talk about students on college campuses protesting. This is not a new phenomenon, right?
Oh, certainly not, right? Most people would instantly go back, right, to certainly the 1960s and even into the early 1970s to start to think about student protest on campus. We can even take it much further back, right, to protests in the 1830s and 1840s when students were starting to espouse, these are largely white campuses in the 1830s and 1840s, but they're starting to espouse anti-slavery ideas, right? And so these battles, what we perceive as battles at this moment, have been part of the very fabric, certainly of higher education in the United States, but I'm part of the larger social and cultural fabric of the nation for quite some time. And we can mark them out for certainly more than 100 years.
So why do you think, I mean, there was uproar in the 60s for Vietnam and the 70s over Vietnam, but it doesn't seem, the vitriol seems higher now. Is that just the society in which we live? Or is it just our perspective? Was it this bad in the 60s?
That's an excellent question. And I've only studied the 60s as I was not yet around. I was around during in the 1980s when there were other kind of divestment campaigns going on, certainly thinking about South Africa in that context. And no, there didn't seem to be, right, this vitriol is the word that you just used. This such stark clash of ideas and ideologies, of even bordering on you know, just hatred that's bubbling up in a variety of different situations. Is that a measure of our time? Is that a measure of a post-COVID moment where everybody retreated online and now we're trying to figure out, right, how to interact with live human beings, in 2024, probably a little mix of everything together, but you know, and then there is that last bit of your question, which is, you know, is it also how we actually experience protest and demonstration in the moment? And I think that there is something to be said about that as well, right? That when it's actually happening and actually going on, it's different than looking back at it 10 years down the road, when it won't look perhaps as virulent, and the vitriol won't seem as sharp. You know, I feel that way. We had a recent another kind of moment, right, where we had Black Lives Matters protests, and in the wake of George Floyd, and I remembered when I was in college, the Rodney King event was seminal to my experience in college, and you know, it seemed so such a stark clash in the 1990s, and then yet looking back at it from 2017, it just didn't seem to have that vibrancy that it had in the moment.
I suppose it also doesn't help that it's in an election year and there is political gain to be made.
Yeah, look, there are real policies at stake. You know, going forward, this is an interesting moment for students to try and capture part of a larger political dialogue and help shape national policy in a way that a non-election year wouldn't have that opening, right?
Well, I was thinking more in terms of the political opportunity to seize anger. Policy, you know, I think is a concept of the past at the moment, where you can mobilize your voters to, you know, reach into their pocket and donate $5.
Ah, fair enough. You're far more jaded than me at this moment.
I spent a lot of time getting this jaded. Well, thank you so much for the conversation. It was really interesting.
Thank you. Thank you, Scott.
Professor Scott Gack at Trinity College in Connecticut. We're following these other stories from around the world. Flash floods and a landslide in central Kenya killed at least 45 people and injured more than 110 others on Monday. Floodwaters swept away homes and cars. NATO members have failed to live up to their promises to Ukraine. According to NATO chief Jens Stoltenberg, he told Ukrainians Monday during an unannounced visit that the flow of arms and ammunition would now increase. China hinted on Monday that it could retaliate after U.S. President Joe Biden signed into law legislation to boost Taiwan's defenses and to get TikTok's Chinese owner to divest. The Chinese Foreign Ministry urged the United States not to implement the negative China-related legislation. In our continuing coverage of the 2024 U.S. presidential election, U.S. Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump is planning to campaign in the Midwestern state of Michigan this week. It's one of a handful of states that could swing the results of November's presidential election. Here's VOA correspondent Scott Stern with our story.
Voters in Michigan chose Donald Trump in 2016, but Joe Biden in 2020. It's a state both campaigns believe they can win this November. Part of Trump's approach in Michigan is winning over auto workers whose jobs he says are threatened by Biden renewable energy plans, including subsidies for electric vehicles. It's a message he's bringing to a rally in central Michigan Wednesday.
We'll be in Michigan, a state that he's destroyed because of the auto industry. We're not going to have any jobs left in Michigan, no auto jobs left in Michigan. They're all going over to China and other places with his ridiculous EV mandate, electric vehicle mandate.
The main union representing auto workers in Michigan endorsed Biden over Trump. Paul Torrente is a union representative.
Donald Trump most likely has the support of big corporations in Michigan because they are the ones that actually hold the working class down. So for him to actually say that he has Michigan, he doesn't have the working people in Michigan. He has the 1%.
That's a message Biden is using to keep union household voters, who an NBC News poll says still favor him over Trump. But by a smaller margin than 4 years ago.
Donald Trump's vision of America is one of revenge and retribution. A defeated former president who sees the world from Mar-a-Lago and bows down to billionaires, who looks down on American union workers, is It's not just he's not supportive, he looks down on us.
A potential liability for Biden in Michigan are traditionally Democratic voters who oppose his support for Israel in the war in Gaza. Omar Suleiman is an imam at the Islamic Center of Detroit.
He is intentionally, I think, pursuing a policy that is not only inhumane and disgusting to everyone that hoped for something different, but will be consequential in November 2024.
In Michigan's Adams Township, voters believe Biden has mishandled immigration and lost control of the border, says Township Supervisor Randy Johnson.
Look how many, and I'm not saying this in a bad way, but look how many people came in. Look how many people we didn't know came in. Look how many bad people came in. Trump's wall would have isolated all that.
Trump says Michiganders are tired of Biden.
This November, the great state of Michigan is going to tell crooked Joe Biden, you're fired, get the hell out of here.
Biden says it's the strength of labor unions that will help him win re-election.
You're the best in the world. You know, you had my back in 2020, and because of you, I'm standing here as president of the United States of America. Because of you. And that's a fact. Because of you, in 2024, we're going to make Donald Trump a loser again.
A CBS News poll of Michigan voters last week found Biden has a slim lead over Trump, with nearly two-thirds of Michiganders saying voting for president this year matters more than it did 4 years ago. Scott Stearns, VOA News.
A twice-delayed legislative election got underway in Togo on Monday, following constitutional reforms that could extend the tenure of President Faure Gnassingbé. Reuters correspondent David Doyle has more.
This election has been pushed back twice due to a fierce backlash from some opposition parties. They say a new charter adopted in March is a political maneuver designed to extend Gnassingbé's tenure for life. In the capital Lomé, Kalanvi Bubuyabu has just cast his vote.
We've always wanted change. That's why we voted, and we hope for that change.
Under the new parliamentary system of government, the president will be elected by parliament instead of by universal suffrage. Details remain unclear, though under the new constitution, Parliament will appoint a position described as President of the Council of Ministers, who will have extensive authority to manage Togo's government affairs. Amendments approved in Parliament earlier in April shortened presidential terms to 4 years from five with a two-term limit. But this does not take into account time already spent in office, which could enable Gnassingbé to stay in power until 2033 if he is re-elected when his mandate expires in 2025. He has not yet stated his intentions. Togo's parliament is effectively under the control of Gnassingbé's UNIR party, after the opposition boycotted the last legislative poll. However, the opposition is taking part this time. Togo has seen years of resistance to the Gnassingbé family's rule. The current president was first elected in 2005 to succeed his father, Gnassingbé Eyadama, who took office in a coup in 1967. Gnassingbé was re-elected in a 2020 election, disputed by the opposition. Police crackdowns on political demonstrations have been routine under Gnassingbé, as they were during his father's rule. Over 4 million people are registered to vote for 113 lawmakers among 2,352 candidates. Provisional results are expected from Tuesday.
Reuters correspondent David Doyle. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Scott Walterman. And finally,
I was supposed to be sent away, but they forgot to come and get me.
Taylor Swift sold 2.61 million album and streaming units of the Tortured Poets Department during its first week of release in the United States. Billboard called it a gigantic debut at number one on the Billboard 200 albums chart. And that's not all. Here's Reuters correspondent Sean Hogan, who says records were shattered.
She's the pop megastar that seemingly doesn't miss, as Taylor Swift's latest album has smashed records once again. Already the top-selling album for 2024, it also scored the largest streaming week for an album ever. Poets is Swift's 14th chart-topping album, tying with Jay-Z for the most number ones among soloists. Music industry expert Mark Sutherland says the stats are incredible.
It's the first ever album to pass a billion streams on Spotify inside a week. It sold more vinyl albums in 3 days than anybody has managed in a week since modern records began. It's the fastest selling album of the year in the UK. You know, we could go on and on and on. I think whatever sort of metric you look at over the last couple of years, Taylor Swift has been setting records that not only did we think never would be broken, but you sort of look at some of them and think, well, unless Taylor's going to break them herself, they'll probably never be broken again.
Swift released the first 16 tracks of Poets on April 19. 2 hours later, she surprised fans by revealing it was a double album with 15 more songs.
And I was just screaming at the phone. I was like, there's no way that she just dropped 15 new songs.
Her US success is mirrored around the world. Swift topped the British music charts on Friday, April 26, outselling the rest of the top 10 combined, while also beating the Beatles' record of the fastest artist to rack up 12 UK number one albums.
Red indeed. Reuters correspondent Sean Hogan. This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you so much for spending this time with us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Scott Walterman.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is frustrated with the stalled effort to achieve a political solution in Syria, said Ambassador Robert Wood, U.S. Alternative Representative for Special Political Affairs at the United Nations. He urged all Security Council members to call on the Syrian regime to finally engage in the political process in good faith. In the meantime, the humanitarian situation in Syria remains bleak. More than 16 million people in Syria depend on assistance, with 10.8 million of the most vulnerable requiring immediate life-saving aid, explained Ambassador Wood.
These staggering numbers confirm, once again, what the humanitarian assistance community and the Syrian people have been saying for years. Not enough aid is getting to those who need it. The 90-day arrangement with the Syrian regime for UN access through Bab al-Salam and Bab al-Rai crossings expires in a few weeks. These two crossings have provided important capacity and enabled faster, more efficient aid deliveries to communities in need, on top of the vital crossing at Bab al-Hawa. The 6-month arrangement for that crossing expires in July.
Extending these arrangements at the last minute is no way to address the daunting scale and persistence of humanitarian needs in Syria, declared Ambassador Wood. With regard to detentions and missing persons, Ambassador Wood welcomed the recent funding of the Independent Institution for Missing Persons in Syria. Families deserve to know the fates and whereabouts of over 155,000 missing or arbitrarily detained persons in Syria by all parties to the conflict. Ambassador Wood reiterated his deep concerns that the Syrian regime has allowed the Iranian-aligned militia groups to operate on its territory, while Iran continues to provide these militias with advanced weapons, intelligence support, financial aid, and training.
Iran's militant proxies and partners only seek to advance their own destabilizing agenda, and it is clear the Syrian people increasingly resent their presence. To prevent further escalation in Syria and neighboring countries, the United States will continue to work with our diplomatic partners toward resolving all the tensions in the region.
The Syrian people have suffered for far too long, and their increasingly dire plight demands a robust response from the international community. We must recommit ourselves, said Ambassador Wood, to providing the necessary funding, political will, and collective action to help Syrians who are in desperate need.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.